Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science of the past week. Our lead story today concerns Europe, the fact that a gigantic heat dome settled over Europe for the past week, causing inconvenience for millions of tourists. In fact, Paris recorded some of the hottest temperatures perhaps in 500 years, temperatures soaring to 109 degrees Fahrenheit, forcing tourists to play in the fountains and the pools, seeking some kind of relief. And the question is it global warming? Are we now beginning to see the first signs, clear signs, of global warming or not? And then let's say a few things about Area 51. That's right. Are there alien bodies being held by the United States government in Area 51 in Nevada? It turns out that what started off as an internet joke has turned into some very serious politics. There was a rumor that started on Facebook that said that, yes, the bodies of aliens are being stored there, and September 20th, you should converge on Area 51 demanding that the Air Force release evidence that, yes, we have been visited. Well, the rumor took off, and over a million people have signed on and said, yes, they too will be there in Area 51 on September 20th. In fact, the rumor got so large that the military had to even reinforce its statement that, yes, Area 51 is secure, it is off limits to the public, and people will be met perhaps with, well, who knows, force. And so the question is there any basis to the rumor? And what should you do if perhaps you believe that there are bodies stored in Area 51 in Nevada? And speaking about outer space, last month, we had the 50th anniversary of the landing of the Apollo 11 spacecraft on the moon. But now that all the hoopla is over, the question is, what's next for the space program? Are we entering the second golden era of space exploration? Or will it wind up like the first? After the first golden era of space exploration, the United States, well, we lost interest. We took our football, went home, and that was the end of the manned exploration of the universe. So what's different this time around? And then there's a new theory of aging that's going around, proposed by the scientists at the University of Southern California, and it actually makes some sense. The old theory of aging, which is probably correct, is that aging is the buildup of errors. Genetic errors, molecular errors, cellular errors, the buildup of errors in our body. But precisely, how does this buildup take place? And is it therefore possible to reverse this aging process given all our vast knowledge about DNA? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top science stories of the past week. Our lead story today comes from Europe, specifically Paris. Temperatures soared to 109 degrees a few days ago, setting off alarm bells all over Europe. Millions of tourists have been inconvenienced. You've probably seen pictures of people playing in wading pools next to the Eiffel Tower, desperately trying to find some relief from this blistering temperature enveloping Europe, all of Europe. And this gigantic heat dome is now moving into Scandinavia, causing records to be broken there, records that we haven't seen, they say, for 500 years. And then it's going to go on and nick the Arctic. And the question is, what's going to happen to the North Pole when we have this gigantic heat dome that has already baked Europe, will bake Scandinavia, and is headed toward the North Pole? Well, first of all, is it global warming? Well, the answer is yes and no. First of all, global warming is an average effect. Therefore, you cannot say, aha, this one storm, this one hot spell, this one forest fire is due to global warming. It doesn't work like that. However, on a graph paper, if you plot all the different parameters of what's happening on the Earth today, you realize it is unmistakable that all the arrows point up and not down. First of all, this gigantic heat dome is going to hit the Arctic region, and already we see the fact that Alaska is thawing out. Even though most of the planet has risen in temperatures by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 50 years, Alaska has recorded a rise in average temperature of 4 degrees in the past 50 years. We also see that in the North Pole. Submarines visited the North Pole 50 years ago, giving us an indication of how thick the ice sheet was over the polar ice caps. Well, submarines have visited the North Pole repeatedly since then, and we find something disturbing. The fact that the thickness of the ice sheet on average has decreased by 50% in the last 50 years. That is a 1% decrease in average thickness per year. And it's going to accelerate, especially because the average temperature on the Earth is rising and accelerating. And personally, I think that this could actually affect our mythology concerning Christmas and Santa Claus. Parents say that Santa Claus lives in the North Pole, but kids will say in the future, ha, that's obviously not true. Everybody knows that there is no permanent ice cover over the North Pole anymore. Not to mention the fact that every major glacier on the planet Earth is receding. We have pictures taken decades ago. We have satellite photographs. And you compare them, you see the recession, the unmistakable recession of all the glaciers on the planet Earth. Also, sea level rise. This is something that's very easy to record because coastal areas have been recording sea level for decades. And we see, yes, sea levels are rising. By the way, sea levels are rising not so much because the ice caps are melting. That's contributing to it. But the real reason why the sea levels are rising is because water expands when it's heated. Therefore, since the oceans are getting hotter, especially over the last 50 years, they're expanding, and that is causing the rise in sea level. Also, if you talk to a farmer, farmers, of course, have to know the weather. Their livelihood depends upon it. And they'll tell you that, yes, summer is about a week longer than average. And this means that planting seasons, and of course, farmers live by the calendar, planting seasons are altered because of the fact that the seasons themselves are changing. Not to mention the fact that this means that tropical diseases, mosquito-borne diseases, are going north as a consequence. And then if you go to the South Pole is beginning to slowly crack. We see huge chunks of the South Pole, about the size of one of the states of the United States of America, breaking off from the South Pole. Things that were not supposed to happen in our lifetime are now happening right before our eyes. And if the South Pole begins to crack, and of course that'll take many, many decades to centuries into the future, but if the South Pole ever begins to crack apart, then you could see a dramatic rise in sea levels around the planet Earth. So once again, you cannot point your finger at the rising temperatures in Europe and say, aha, that is proof of global warming. No, but if you take a look at the average effects, you see swings in the climate, and that is the characteristic of global warming. Global warming, in fact, is a misnomer. It's not a uniform warming at all. It swings. Just like I get a pail of water, add energy to it, and the water sloshes back and forth. The same thing on the Earth. When the Earth traps sunlight, energy, the raw energy that the Earth receives from the sun increases because it's captured by carbon dioxide. That energy sloshes around. So in one area, you have droughts. In another area, you have flooding, like what's happening in Japan right now, massive flooding in Japan, forest fires in one area, and cold snaps in another. And so it's not a uniform heating up of the planet Earth. So in the middle of summer, some people can point to cold weather and vice versa. But you see, that's what global warming is all about. Global swings. So you have forest fires in one area, droughts in another area. And all these disturbances are 1-in-100-year events. And when you connect the dots, that's when you see the pattern of global warming. Also, speaking about the planet Earth, have we been visited by aliens from outer space? Did one of their craft crash in 1947 outside Roswell, New Mexico? And are their bodies stored in Nevada at a top secret area called Area 51? Well, it started off as a joke. Somebody put on Facebook a joke saying, hey, let's all converge on Area 51 in the Nevada and demand that the government reveal the fact that, yes, not only have we been visited, but we have the smoking gun. We have the bodies of the aliens who perished in a crash. Well, that thing took off. And now millions of people have said that, yes, they want to be there. Now, of course, it's still a joke. We don't really know how many people are going to pay for the airfare, go into the middle of the desert, into a deserted area, and face a military probably armed to the teeth to protect top secret facilities. We don't know. However, it's become serious business now because the military is warning people to stay away and, of course, to stay nonviolent. Well, first of all, these jokes happened rather frequently. Back in 1973, there was a famous one where Johnny Carson, who ruled the evening night talk shows, talked about a shortage of toilet paper. That's right. He said that there's a shortage of toilet paper, and if you don't want to be caught flat-footed, you may want to go to the store and stock up on toilet paper. Well, it was a joke. But guess what happened? Millions of people went to the store to stock up on toilet paper, causing a shortage. So you got to take these things seriously. People will undergo herd mentality, and that's why there's a potential danger there. If you're thinking about going to Area 51 in the middle of a desert, just remember, keep it peaceful. Of course, people are allowed to voice their dissent. We live in a democratic society, but we don't want to have violent confrontations with the authorities. And then the next question is, well, what's fueling it? What's fueling it is the fact that recently the United States Air Force and military pilots have revealed, quote, the smoking gun. That is, photographs showing on radar that, yes, they have encountered objects that seem to zigzag, leave no visible exhaust trail, and travel at hypersonic velocities, much faster than our supersonic jets. Our jets are left in the dust. And some people say, aha, that's what we need to show that these things really are true. So after everything is said and done, you may ask yourself a question, well, what is my own personal point of view? My own personal point of view is that, well, when I talk to my colleagues about the possibility of UFOs and things like that, most of my friends' eyes roll up into their head. They look at the sky and they shake their heads and they simply say, bah, humbug. The distance between stars is so great that it would take centuries to go between stars, and no civilization is going to colonize the galaxy because the galaxy is huge, and it would simply take centuries to go from one star to the next. Well, yes, that's true, but that assumes that the alien technology is only maybe 100 years more advanced than us. You see, 100 years from now, we probably will be sending the first starships to the nearby stars. But what happens if the aliens are millions of years ahead of us? Then new laws of physics begin to open up. Space and time become unstable at what is called the Planck energy. The Planck energy is what we think the next frontier is. It's where Einstein's theories totally break down, and we have to incorporate the quantum theory into relativity to give us a quantum theory of gravity, and all bets are off at that point. And so I think we simply cannot laugh and dismiss the existence of aliens in outer space because we simply don't know. And we shouldn't assume that their technology is only 100 years more advanced than our technology. Plus the fact that we've already identified 4,000 planets in our own backyard, the Milky Way galaxy, 4,000 extrasolar planets, a handful of them look very much like the planet Earth. They are what are called super-Earths. They're a little bit bigger than the planet Earth. Some of them have oceans, we think. And if you have oceans, you can have water, DNA, oxygen, and the basic ingredients for life. So we can't rule out the fact that, yes, there could be civilizations out there that are thousands, maybe millions of years more advanced than us, in which case going between stars is not such a big deal. For example, in my book, The Future of Humanity, I mention one technology that I came up with, and this is what I call laser porting. And that is that within 100 years or so, we on the planet Earth will probably have the ability to digitize consciousness. That is, the ability to digitize everything known about the brain, everything known about our patterns, our personality, our patterns of thought. And all this information could be encoded on a laser beam. All the information necessary to create a reasonable carbon copy of your thinking process. And since it's encoded on a laser beam, we can shoot it to the moon. In 1 second, your, quote, consciousness, unquote, is on the moon. In 20 minutes, you could be on Mars. In 4 years, you could be on the nearest star, traveling at the speed of light. So if all this information that stores all the gigabytes of memory inside your brain is sent to the moon, then there's a receiving station. A receiving station on the moon that then downloads all the information stored on that laser beam and then puts it into an avatar. The avatar could either be a hologram or it could actually be a robot. A robot that looks like you but has superpowers and is fully capable of wandering around the moon, Mars, and around the universe. So I call this laser porting. It's very convenient because you don't have booster rockets. You don't have to worry about accidents, weightlessness. It's basically pure thought, pure consciousness encoded on a laser beam, shot throughout the universe, downloaded on different planets, and then put into a robot which can breathe any atmospheric composition. And this means that in the morning, you could have breakfast in New York. In 1 second, you can laser port yourself to the moon, walk around the moon. 20 minutes later, you're on Mars. A few hours later, you're walking on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And then you come back for dinner back in New York, all of which obeys the laws of physics. I have violated no law of physics. And like I said, you don't even have to wait millions of years for this to be true. 100 years. Within 100 years, we'll have this technology without having to bankrupt ourselves building starships. Now, let me stick my neck out. I think this may already exist, that aliens out there may have centuries ago given up on rockets and instead used laser beams to shoot their consciousness throughout the galaxy, exploring the galaxy at the speed of light. This, I think, would be the most efficient way to explore the universe. No accidents to worry about, no weightlessness problems, no radiation problems. Basically, exploring the universe on a light beam. And also, there's new news on the aging front. Some people have asked the question, with all this technology that we have, why do we have to die? Why do we have to get old? Well, there's a new theory that says that aging is nothing but the buildup of error, genetic error, cellular error, molecular error, mistakes. Mistakes form in the process of living. These mistakes build up, and cells go into a state called senescence. They become sluggish. They become slow. They don't reproduce. And that's why tissue starts to age and look old and sag. And eventually, they die. In fact, that's why we die. But then the question is, can we reverse it? Well, think of a car. Where in a car does aging take place? Well, obviously the engine. That's where you have moving parts. That's where you have combustion. That's where you have the buildup of gum, like carbon deposits. And where is the engine of a cell? The mitochondria. Well, bingo. If you could somehow rewire the genes of the mitochondria, repair the aging genes, then perhaps the cells do not have to go into senescence. Well, there's a new theory coming out from the University of Southern California that says yes, but let's take this one step farther. And that is, maybe senescence is, quote, deliberate. Maybe the body deliberately, quote unquote, creates cells that go into senescence because otherwise they become cancerous. You see, we are very complex objects. Our cells reproduce and mistakes build up and they cause cancer. And cancer, of course, can kill you. The body, because of evolution, tries to find a defense mechanism against cancer, and that is senescence. So in other words, when you enter a period called senescence, your skin starts to sag, your body starts to fall apart slowly, but it's a defense mechanism against cancer because the cells in senescence cannot reproduce. That's what cancer is, reproduction without control. Cells that simply don't die, cells that simply reproduce and eventually kill you. That's why we have cancer. So maybe senescence is quote-unquote deliberate, that is engineered deliberately by evolution, which is not conscious, of course, but evolution creates cells that deliberately undergo the process of senescence. Otherwise, they become cancerous. If so, then there's yet another mechanism to defeat aging. And that is eliminate senescent cells. In other words, scientists have concentrated all this firepower, this genetic firepower on cancer. But maybe we've hit the wrong target. Maybe the real problem is senescent cells. Cells that become sluggish, slow, they don't reproduce very well. That's why your skin sags. That's why you get old. That is aging, not death, but aging. And this new theory says that maybe we've targeted the wrong foe, that maybe we should try to eliminate senescent cells. That's a new approach. And in this approach, all we have to do is find ways of somehow flushing out senescent cells as they form so that young cells can replace the senescent cells. Well, of course, this is just a theory, but it's a theory that seems to dovetail with the previous experience that we've had, and that is that aging is not a mystery. Aging is the buildup of error. And if we could somehow control the error, either by rerouting the error, correcting the mistakes, or by eliminating senescent cells, perhaps that is the secret of the fountain of youth. Also, a few weeks ago, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Apollo landing on the moon. And then the next question is, well, so what? I mean, are we going to make the same mistake that we did 50 years ago and let the whole program go to pot? So we have to ask ourselves a question, are we entering the second golden era of space exploration, or are we simply repeating the mistakes of the first? Well, first of all, what happened? The history of space travel can be summarized in one word, and that is cost, C-O-S-T. We had the two superpowers that were competing back in the 1960s, and budgets were not a problem. In 1966, the Apollo budget was 5% of the U.S. federal budget. Let me repeat that again. 5% of every dollar that you gave to the government in taxes went to the moon program. That's incredible. That's unsustainable. And sure enough, after landing on the moon a few times, the United States picked up a football and went home, never to return back to the moon. And that's because crash programs are good because they attain the goal, but that's all. What about the follow-up? What about step two? that never was put into place because of the fact that so much effort went into the Apollo space program. Now we're entering the second golden era of space exploration where costs have dropped dramatically. For example, if you ride in a car and then junk your car after one ride, cars would be extremely expensive and it would bankrupt the nation. But that's what we do with rockets. After one trip, we junk the rocket. And that's why rockets are so expensive. But why not reuse the rockets? And that, of course, is what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX, trying to reuse the rocket and also inject private financing to help with the budget. You realize that we now have not one, but three potential moon rockets, two of which are financed by private dollars. First, we have the SLS booster rocket paid for by taxpayers' money, and it's already over budget. People think that it may cost $1 billion per mission, $1 billion each time the SLS booster rocket is fired up. And some critics are saying that it may never fire up at all. The costs are skyrocketing to the point where it simply may be more economical to junk the rocket rather than to try to fire it up. Meanwhile, we have Elon Musk with the Falcon Heavy rocket, which has already demonstrated the capability of shooting an object all the way out to Mars. It shot a dummy space capsule with a dummy human on board, and it'll eventually perhaps collide with Mars. And then we have Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world, who is sponsoring the Blue Origin program, which contains the new Armstrong rocket, which is also capable, we think, of going to the moon. Not to mention the fact that the Indians successfully had a mission to the moon recently. And it means that costs are dropping, even though NASA's budget is being ballooned out of control because of the SLS booster rocket. The point is, however, that costs in the main are dropping, and we could be entering a second golden era of space exploration where we don't have to break the bank. Now, personally, I prefer robots because robots are cheap, they can explore the universe, and they don't complain, and most important, they don't have to come back. But I also realize that the dinosaurs did not have a space program, and that's why there are no dinosaurs here in this room. Because of the fact that they were caught totally flat-footed when that asteroid or comet hit the Yucatan of Mexico 65 million years ago. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Joseph Rom. It's a pre-recorded interview, and he gives a rather scary projection of what global warming could do to the planet in the coming decades. And the book with a disturbing title is Hell and High Water. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first part of Exploration, we talked about the severe weather affecting Europe. Temperatures have skyrocketed to 109 degrees in Paris, France. Temperatures apparently not seen for the past 500 years. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Joseph Rom, in a pre-recorded interview talking about what happens when we have hell and high water. In fact, that's the name of his book, Hell and High Water. So we are talking about what happens to sea level rise, what happens to the climate if trends continue and the degradation of the atmosphere accelerates. Once again, our special guest is Dr. Joseph Rom. The book is called Hell and High Water.
And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Dr. Joseph Rom. He's the founder of the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions. He's also been a former acting assistant secretary at the Department of Energy. And he's the author of a, well, rather scary book. It's called Hell and High Water and What We Should Do About It. It's a book about global warming that'll scare the pants off you. He uses the most authoritative, the best computer projections to look into the world of 2020, 2050, and 2100, and he finds out that, well, yes, many cities of the United States are going to be underwater, the coastline of America will be unrecognizable, and of course, this means trillions of dollars in damages, not to mention hundreds of millions of peoples whose lands will be submerged underwater. This also means food famines, it also means food riots, it also means a collapse of the old civilizations as we knew them. So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Joseph Rom, and the title of his disturbing book is Hell and High Water. The first question for you, Dr. Rom, is how did you, as a student, get interested in the whole question of global warming?
Sure. Well, I think the answer to that question is that about 1990, I talked to a lot of the top experts in energy security and in national security and asked them what were the emerging problems facing the planet. And a surprising number of them said that it was global warming, and so that's sort of when I realized I wanted to understand the subject more, and I started working with Amory Lovins on energy efficiency matters and studying up on global warming, and ultimately I ended up at the Department of Energy working on greenhouse gas mitigation technologies and helping push energy efficiency and renewable energy.
Okay, well, just a few weeks ago, the United Nations issued its mammoth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, authored by 600 scientists, peer-reviewed by 600 more scientists, so at least 1,200 scientists were involved in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Summarize for us a little bit what the report said.
Well, the report, which is a consensus of the top scientists in the world, basically said that it is very likely that the warming that we've seen in the past 50 years is due to human emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, and that is a pretty strong statement. That, you know, I think everyone understands that the weather is changing. You know, we in Washington D.C. we had cherry blossoms bloom in January. So the question that the global warming deniers, the people who've been trying to block action on climate change, have been saying is, well, okay, the climate is changing, but humans aren't the cause. So this report lays that to rest. Humans are the cause. And what's more, in the future, we can expect 3 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit warming this century, rising sea levels, more intense hurricanes, droughts, wildfires, and the like. So it's a pretty alarming picture.
Okay, well, I just got back from speaking in Switzerland, and there we have this $130 billion tourist industry over wintertime, which might collapse because the snows only exist at the very tops of the Alps. And so summarize a little bit what's happening with the glaciers of the Earth, what's happening with the North Polar region and the South Polar region.
Well, as the planet warms, it warms even more at the poles, and you get this amplifying effect where you're replacing white snow or white ice with either blue ocean or dark land. So instead of reflecting more light, you get more absorption of heat and light. So the poles get warmer and warmer, and we've seen a dramatic decrease, about 25%, in the extent of the Arctic pole sea ice, and we've been seeing rapid melting of the glaciers. Those include the inland glaciers, but more importantly, Greenland and Antarctica have been losing ice rapidly at their edges and starting to cause sea levels to rise faster than had been previously predicted.
And isn't it true that some point in the near future, the North Polar region may be totally ice-free during summertime, which would then change the whole climate of the North Polar region?
Absolutely. I think there's now a consensus that it's happening so fast that it might well happen in the lifetime of the listeners to your show. And that is quite alarming because it hasn't been, the Arctic hasn't been ice-free for at least a million years. And as you say, it would change the climate dramatically.
And going back in time, we've had scientists who've analyzed ice cores, that is, drilling into the ice and extracting atmospheric conditions that existed hundreds of thousands of years ago. So how does the current rise in temperature within the last 50 years compare to the weather going back hundreds of thousands of years?
Well, we are getting close. We're about 2 degrees Fahrenheit away from the warmest that we were in the past few hundred thousand years. And if we go back to just 125,000 years ago, 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, sea levels were about 15 feet higher. There wasn't much ice in Greenland. So that would be a catastrophe when you consider that just 3 feet of sea level rise would cause 100 million environmental refugees around the planet.
Okay, now one thing your book does in very graphic detail, I thought, was to estimate what's going to happen in the next 20, 50, and 100 years if this continues unabated. And in your book, you talk about, first of all, the state of Florida. Tell us a little bit about what Florida is going to look like in 2100 if these conditions continue unabated.
Well, indeed, and I titled the book Hell and High Water because the consequences, I think, are fairly dire. And the high water part of this is that as the seas rise, the lowest lying areas in this country get flooded. And if anyone who's ever traveled to South Florida or the Keys knows, the entire bottom 100 miles of Florida are extremely shallow. And I think it's rather likely on our current path that by the 2100 and possibly by 2050, we will have flooded most of that area and had to abandon it, in some sense, back to nature.
And let me just read to you a few sentences from your book. You say that in this particular scenario, by 2100, some 400 million people worldwide will be exposed to the rising seas. And then talking about Florida, you write, in this country, one quarter of Florida will be submerged. And one-third would be underwater when sea levels rise, hit 7.6 meters, or about 25 feet. So in other words, what you're talking about is redrawing the shape of the United States of America, aren't you?
Oh, I think that that is inevitable, and I think, you know, it's not that likely that we would see 7.6 meters this century, but I think it is very likely that we would know, even within 20 years, that we had kind of waited too long to stop this inexorable sea level rise. And at that point, people would have to decide which major cities along the coast we were going to save. And I think your listeners can appreciate, we saw with Hurricane Katrina that if a city has a large portion of its land under sea level, it's very hard to protect it from a major hurricane. So once South Florida is, you know, below sea level. People can put up levees if they want, but, you know, this is the dead center spot for where hurricanes hit, and, you know, the likelihood that we could, you know, save the Florida, and this is the same is true as Louisiana up to Baton Rouge and large parts of North Carolina and Delaware and Texas would be flooded. Yes, the map would be redrawn, and we'd have to we'd probably abandon the smaller coastal cities and try, like the Dickens, to protect, you know, Miami and Houston and New York.
And let me read again from your book. Louisiana, as you pointed out, would be in the same capsized boat flooded up to Baton Rouge. In Texas, Galveston, Corpus Christi, Beaumont, and Port Arthur would be submerged. Houston would be seriously at risk and difficult to protect from a combination of rising sea levels and super hurricanes. Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Virginia's major coastal areas, one-fourth of Delaware, most land along Chesapeake Bay, and huge sections of such cities as Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston would be flooded. So tell us a little bit about New York City. I'm right here in New York City. I was watching Fox News a few months ago, and they talked about the possibility of maybe New York City being flooded. And they said, well, we'll just build dikes around Manhattan anyway. So what are your thoughts? What is New York City and Boston and Washington going to look like if sea levels continue to rise?
Well, I think that it, you know, New York City, as the earth gets warmer, the ocean gets warmer, we'll see hurricanes extend their reach further and further, and it's certainly not unprecedented for New York City to be hit by a hurricane, and I think it's true that we could put levees around the city. I think that we would have to put levees around the city, but, you know, we may be ending up in a situation where in 50 years sea levels are rising 3 inches a decade, and maybe and accelerating, so that it becomes progressively, I think people have to understand, we're not talking about seas rising just like 3 feet and stopping. That would be easy to prepare for. People should understand that on the path that we are on today, we will warm 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. That would take us to a temperature the Earth hasn't seen for several million years, when sea levels were 80 feet higher. Now, the 80 feet doesn't happen overnight, but it can happen over a period of many, many decades, and it just gets progressively harder and harder to protect your cities. So, yes, I think in the near term, you would put levees around New York, you'd put levees around Boston where you could, but, you know, you can't protect your entire coastline from sea levels that are 20 feet higher or 40 feet higher or 80 feet higher. It just becomes absurd.
In the past, New York City has been hit by nor'easters and hurricanes, which have dumped so much water into the subway system that it basically paralyzed the New York subway system. Thank God it was only momentarily. However, I guess it's a preview of what could happen if we have storm surges, in which case subway systems would be totally ground to a halt, right? Paralyzing the whole city.
Well, that's what the and I think the Weather Channel even had a show on what happens if just a Category 3 hurricane were to come up, come up directly towards Manhattan and push an immense storm surge. My brother, you asked how I got into climate change. The reason I wrote this book is because my brother lost his home in Hurricane Katrina. He was a mile inland, and they had 22 feet of water in their house. And I wanted to advise him as to whether or not to rebuild. So I talked to a lot of the top hurricane experts and climate experts, and that's what sort of led me to get very alarmed and write this particular book, because I've spent most of my life on the solution side of the problem. As you say, it's very, very hard to protect a major metropolis from huge storm surge associated with a hurricane.
And also, of course, you talk about the third world and other areas of the planet like Bangladesh. Bangladesh and low-lying islands, won't they gradually disappear off the map?
Well, indeed, and obviously poor countries don't have the financial wherewithal to put in expensive and extensive levees and and move their population easily. So, you know, you're going to see the coasts of China, the coasts of Egypt, the coasts of Bangladesh, India, just completely redrawn as sea levels rise. And the exodus of, you know, 100 to 400 million people over the course of several decades. Now, again, this isn't going to happen tomorrow, but we're going to know that it's pretty darn hard to stop if we don't take action soon. That's what we have to do. We have to start acting now, and which means, you know, since President Bush is opposed to any substantive action, we have to wait until we have a new president in 2009. But, you know, in 2009, we need to take strong action if we're going to avoid the worst of global warming.
Now, one report I read says that if you want to see what the weather is going to look like in the next 20 to 50 years, look south. For example, the United States will look more like Mexico, and Canada, large portions of Canada, will look more like the growing areas of the United States. That's just a rule of thumb. It's not precise, of course. But what are your thoughts? Is it true that the United States could become gradually much hotter and that Canada will gradually thaw out, releasing, of course, methane into the atmosphere, which will speed up the process? But Canada could become the next United States.
Well, again, it could be that way for a period of a few decades, but that just all the possibility that we would warm a bit and stop requires us to start taking action now. But you're absolutely right. It's going to get much hotter here. Places like Washington, D.C. are going to see temperatures around 90 degrees Fahrenheit or more for the entire summer. And the worrisome thing is, as you said, the tundra, the permafrost in Canada and Siberia and Alaska contains huge amounts of carbon locked away. It's basically like your freezer with a lot of decaying plant matter, but because it's frozen, it doesn't release any emissions. But once it starts to melt, which it's doing now, it can release huge amounts of methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. In fact, it's 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So people sometimes think, oh, well, some countries will do better because of a slight warming. Well, if we were only going to have a slight warming, some countries were going to do better. But we're on path for, you know, unremitting warming.
Okay, now let's get into the second part of your book, where you give a positive program.
Yes.
We have not yet hit the point of no return, and you actually list quite a few very sane, reasonable things that can be done. So let's just take a few of them and rattle them off. You talk about plug-in hybrids, which you think are a better alternative than the hydrogen car. Could you elaborate?
Sure. Well, right now, people can go out and buy a hybrid vehicle which has a gasoline engine and an electric motor, and the electric motor is run by a battery that gets charged by the gasoline engine or gets charged when the car brakes. You can imagine putting in a bigger battery on board the car that could actually be charged off of the electric grid. And so as the electric grid gets cleaner, and of course we will need policies to make the electric grid cleaner, your car could go maybe 20 to 40 miles on electricity before it reverted to gasoline. And since most people don't use their car for very long trips, most of the time you drive to work, you could charge at work, drive it home, charge at home, and you could replace most of the gasoline usage with electricity. And in the coming decades, we need to make our electricity cleaner. So this is, I think, the most effective way to switch from off of gasoline. Hydrogen, I wrote a book called The Hype About Hydrogen, which explained why I don't think hydrogen cars are the answer. And my new book, Hell and High Water, has a, you know, summarized discussion of why hydrogen cars aren't very practical and why plug-in hybrids are probably the car of the near future.
Okay, well, hydrogen does not generate new power. It simply transmits power from existing sources like coal-fired electric plants into mechanical work. So what you're saying is, therefore, that hydrogen masks the problem because it simply transports energy, But the energy comes from coal-fired plants. So is that your main criticism against hydrogen?
Well, hydrogen is mostly made from fossil fuels today. I have a bunch of criticisms of hydrogen. Hydrogen fuel cell cars are currently very expensive, hundreds of thousands of dollars a piece. Hydrogen is a gas, which means it's very hard to cram enough on board your car to give you the kind of range, driving range that people expect. Hydrogen is expensive. There aren't any fueling stations for hydrogen, so someone would have to go out and build them. Hydrogen is, as you say, currently made mostly from natural gas, but it currently releases greenhouse gases when it's being made. And if you were going to make hydrogen from renewable power, it would make a lot more sense just to use the renewable power to run a plug-in hybrid than it would be to go to all the trouble of converting the renewable electricity to hydrogen just so that you could run it through a fuel cell in your car and convert it back to electricity to run an electric motor on your car. So I don't think that hydrogen cars are going to be the answer anytime soon, and perhaps never.
And as you correctly pointed out, most people do their chores within, let's say, 60 miles, and you could run purely on electric batteries in the first 60 miles, handling most of your suburban chores or even commuting chores, right?
Yep.
Okay, let's get into other technologies, solar, wind, and conservation. What are your thoughts about them?
Well, energy efficiency is a strategy to use energy more wisely with better lighting, heating, cooling, better motors. And it's an underutilized strategy. And the fact of the matter is that, as I say in the book, the state of California has been able to keep its electricity per capita flat for three decades now, whereas the rest of the country has gone up 60% in electricity per capita. So if we could just emulate the aggressive energy efficiency strategies of the state of California, we would go a long way towards not having to build new fossil fuel-fired power plants, and then we could use renewable power, especially wind, where the U.S. has a tremendous wind resource in the middle of the country, and the most important thing we need to do is to capture as much of that wind as possible and put it onto the electric grid.
Okay, now what about solar? Some people say that solar cells are expensive, but they're within striking distance of being competitive if we have tax credits and subsidies and what have you. What are your thoughts about the future of solar?
Well, solar is kind of expensive. Its big advantage is that it's got no moving parts. The systems can last a very long time, and they generate electricity when you need it most, which is during the peak power demand times of the midday. So solar is getting to be more competitive. New technologies are bringing the cost down quite rapidly. So I think there's no question that solar is going to be part of the answer, but there's the potential for wind in the nearer term is considerably larger.
And what are your prospects for oil and coal? Some people say that we're gradually going to run out of oil. We have a lot more coal, but of course coal is a lot more polluting with mercury and the unburnt hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. But what are your thoughts about oil and coal?
Well, I think I have a discussion in Hell and High Water of how perhaps there is a way to take coal and to convert it into, because it's a hydrocarbon, into carbon dioxide and hydrogen, and to bury the hydrogen, called carbon capture and storage or carbon sequestration. And that strategy could potentially allow us to keep using coal and generate large volumes of hydrogen that could be run through power plants. So that is one scenario. It is research and development that is being very actively pursued. It's not a slam dunk, but it is an important strategy to pursue. Oil, I think we are going to peak in conventional oil in the next 10 or 20 years. There is a lot of unconventional oil in the world, including the Canadian tar sands and shale in Colorado, and the possibility of converting coal to oil, which is a very polluting and particularly a bad idea. But nonetheless, if we don't take action pretty quickly to limit greenhouse gas emissions, to cap carbon emissions, you're going to see an increase in coal, and you're going to see an increase in dirtier forms of liquid fuels. So, you know, the time is now for action.
And do you foresee a time we're going to have an energy mix, not so dependent on oil and coal, but an energy mix of wind power and, as you mentioned, plug-in hybrids and conservation?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I think that, you know, if you read Hell and High Water, that's the scenario that avoids, you know, 80 feet of sea level rise.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Joseph Rahm, author of a disturbing book called Hell and High Water. I should also point out, however, that I don't think that we have crossed the point of no return. I think that if we were to take our destiny in our hands, it might be possible to reverse some of the trends that are affecting the atmosphere of the planet and our very livelihood. So once again, I think there's hope. I think we have not yet hit the point of no return. In fact, I think there are several points of no return. And fortunately, there's still some time if we can seize the moment and begin the process of reining carbon dioxide emissions. Many proposals have been made. However, it takes political will. It takes the will of the people in order to push the politicians and the scientists and funding agencies to the point where they'll begin to realize that, yeah, something really is happening with the atmosphere of the planet. And unless we do something, something very bad could happen to the weather, to the coastline, to our very livelihood. And so once again, our special guest today was Dr. Joseph Rahm. The book has a rather disturbing title, Hell and High Water. Well, that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and you're listening to Exploration. Join us every week when we discuss science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.